Hi, come on in, come on in. Welcome to the final day of the South by Southwest conference programming. In fact, I think this is the last climate panel, climate talk in the whole conference. Thanks. When I saw the lightning and rain this morning, I was like, oh, this is exactly what we need for a climate conversation. It's like, if we needed to highlight the issue any more than the fires that are raging throughout Texas at the moment, this is the way to do it. But my name's Elliot Kotek. I'm obviously from further south than Texas, just be moderating this panel for you today. Talking about fossil fuel phase out, why it's important, how much of a problem this represents, and talking to some of the people who are doing some of the great work with companies, with the private sector, with the public sector as well, and then also speaking to consumers and the broader markets, and doing that comms, those communication strategies that are so important. So I will get going. We'll get underway with a few little intros. And I've totally given us a small crowd. If you have any questions or you want anything addressed, I'd love to make this worthwhile for each of you. So feel free just to go up to the mic at any point, and we can call on you and we can make this an engaged conversation. So if you've got anything you want to ask, jump to the mic and we'll get going and have some good conversation, hopefully, and make it interesting. So Aaron, take it away, please.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We're almost at the end of the road, small crowd, but we're so glad you're with us. I'm Aaron Pickering. I head up our purpose and sustainability practice at Headstand, which is a boutique brand strategy agency, part of the Stagwell Network. We advise both public and private organizations on setting and achieving and communicating programs that advance business and social and environmental impact. I founded a Purpose Center of Excellence last year with Allison Worldwide, which became the largest agency to sign the Clean Creatives Pledge, committing not to work with the fossil fuel industry. And just a quick shout out to Duncan Mizell in the audience. He has been kind of leading this brave charge to change the way that we think about the fossil fuel smokescreen and greenwashing. So thanks for being with us, Duncan.
Great. We can definitely follow up with that later on and talk about what the Clean Creatives is for people who might want to join as well. Robin, I'd like to thank Robin Rather for filling in. She's local here to Austin, Texas. It's a full circle moment for me. We had a project here around grassroots innovation that we received an award for at South by last year, being innovation in media. At the South by Southwest Innovation Awards. And at the time, Robin's dad was receiving South by's Hall of Fame Award, the great Dan Rather. So it's a nice circular moment for us to have you with us this year. And thanks so much for coming in last minute and lending your expertise to this conversation.
Oh, it's a great honor. I'm Robin Rather. My father says that I'm the most idealistic person he's ever met, and he doesn't mean it as a compliment at all. I'm talking at all. But I'm going to try to bring my most optimistic self to you all today. We need that. We crave that. It's essential. This topic is a tough one. How many people believe we can actually phase out fossil fuels? Just a show of hand. Okay, we've got a room full of optimists already. I consider myself a hybrid. On the one hand, I have done a lot of environmental straight-up activism, specializing in water protection in particular. On the other hand, if I have a superpower, I'm a trained facilitator and mediator, and I specialize in Mission Impossible. Take these diverse stakeholders that hate each other, get them loving each other, create a good vibe, get some practical solutions on the ground, get them funded, let's go. It's harder to do that than to be an activist, and I look forward to talking with you all about that.
Great. Good morning, everyone. My name is Stephen Clark, Program Director for Climate and Energy for an organization in Massachusetts called Ceres. We work with leading companies and investors to make the economy more sustainable and just. and engage in a variety of different types of work, whether it's policy at the federal and state level, working with investors. We have an investor network that has somewhere like, don't quote me on this number, like $60 trillion in assets under management, something like that. So a lot of the big pension funds.
Did you notice how, you said that very casually. Did you say that again?
What? Well, it's because he took his tie off and he's exactly. holding it in his hand, so he has to say things casually now.
It's way more, much more money than I could count. So a significant amount of money and power, which we are trying to organize to bring about these changes that this fantastic panel is going to be discussing today. So it's a pleasure and honor to be here with all of you.
We'll follow straight up on that, Stephen. Given your work leading clean energy and climate and working with corporate leadership, I'll also give a little shout out. Stephen also worked at the in the governor's office in Massachusetts for a little while. I'm guessing it wasn't Mitt Romney or Calvin Coolidge or Samuel Adams, probably a bit more. A bit more recent than that. My son played Samuel Adams in a school play this week, so all about the governors of Massachusetts right now. Give us a sense of the scale of Ceres, like how many companies you're working with across what industries and how that relates to the world's carbon footprint.
Yeah, sure. So we have one of our flagship climate and clean energy programs is called Ambition 2030, and it's focused on decarbonizing the six largest emitting sectors in the economy. So that's banking, power, electric power, oil and gas, food, transportation, and heavy industry, including steel. So those six sectors account for 80%+ of all greenhouse gas emissions in North America. We also work with several of the leading companies in our economy in each of those different sectors. And most of those companies account for 80%+ of emissions within each of those sectors. Part of the reason why we're very focused on those sectors is we've arrived at this moment where sectoral and systemic change is really critical to get us to the point where we can get to net zero emissions before 2050. So that's sort of been part of the pivot that we've made. We used to really focus on moving some of the leading companies. In addition to that, we're very focused on moving these entire sectors to get each of those six sectors in net zero.
That's great. Thanks, Stephen, for mentioning the net zero initiatives. I know that some people think we should go further than that. Aaron, in addition to the comms work you've done with AFLAC and CVS and Petco, you counseled the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty at COP28 not too long ago. Obviously, they've had some success in signing some people up. Can you give us a sense of what that mission is and where you kind of bridge that divide from net zero to non-proliferation and what that actually means?
Sure, absolutely. I think, you know, I actually supported Ceres for a number of years too. And so the great part about where we're at today is you can see the momentum that's being driven by corporate and investor action. You can also see where that's not enough and where we need access to all of the levers we can pull. And so I think that the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, what that brings to the table, it's a non-profit but grassroots organization. And it's actually not an organization. It's a group of organizations who come together to advocate for a just transition from fossil fuels. And so I think I just want to pause on a just transition, because I think when we talk about transitioning away from fossil fuels, so many people hit the panic button and kind of want to say, wait a minute, how are we going to fuel our cars and our homes? How are we going to power our electronics? But what I love about what the Fossil Fuel Treaty does is they ask people to think about what a just transition looks like. How will we continue to create jobs in the industry as we continue to see fossil fuels phasing out? That initiative at COP28 was one of the key drivers of fossil fuels being included in the text coming out of COP28, even though that didn't go far enough either. For the first time, we're seeing an acknowledgement that fossil fuels as an industry need to continue to diversify their portfolios and diversify the way that they're sourcing energy for the future.
Yeah, and just a shout out to the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. One of our original panelists, Sephora Berman, was denied entry to the US, which is the reason why she couldn't be with us, because of her activism and civil disobedience arrests that she's gone through in Canada primarily. But Just a quick stat on that is that the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty signed up 12 countries, 9 indigenous nations, various states of the US, more than 100 cities, more than 3,000 scientists, the World Health Organization, religious groups like the Vatican. But what they were really about, which was what I thought was really cool, A, you can sign up also as an individual. There's over 600,000 people who've taken that pledge. But is that it was kind of a very simple mandate and wasn't as scary as the title suggested when you think about nuclear proliferation treaties and the drama and crisis that that sort of evokes. But really it's just about ending the expansion of fossil fuel investment and structures and infrastructure, winding down the production of fossil fuels and accelerating the transition to clean and low carbon, which actually doesn't seem so scary.
It's not, and you actually had the Colombian government at COP28 become one of the endorsers of the treaty. So if you can imagine a country like Colombia being able to commit to ongoing diversification, it's major, and it sends a signal that it's actually not as far off as we might think.
You know, Aaron, I'd like to bring in one thought here. Part of what I think is dragging us down, not to harsh our buzz on the optimism train, but I think a lot of corporate clients that I've worked with, I think they think we're soft. And what I mean by that is, and it's still not, it's also not a compliment, I think they believe we're not willing to make the sacrifices. We're not willing to go without air conditioning. And as a Texan, those words don't just flow out of my mouth very easily. They don't think we're willing to drive less. They don't think we're willing to sacrifice. And I wanted to ask you all if you think that's part of the slow roll, because we can be optimists, but we can also recognize a lot of companies are slow rolling their butt off. Yeah. And part of that's because they know we're going to keep buying gas, keep cranking the AC, keep wasting water. In my mind, if they thought we were tougher, they might move faster. Question.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen, I'm sure you have thoughts on this too. I would just say from a consumer perspective, right, I think hypothetically we see that, you know, we see these stats all the time. 9 out of 10 consumers want, you know, to phase out fossil fuels. We know that the demand is there, at least in the back of folks' mind, but when it comes to making those trade-offs, I do think in many ways it is unfair for corporations to pass the buck to consumers. But what are those ways that we can leverage consumer momentum to drive the change we need to see if the fossil fuel industry is contributing 75% of global GHG emissions, right? So how do we turn the pressure on them, leveraging consumers, kind of demand for progress, but not passing the buck to them is something we think about all the time. We are seeing a lot of companies backtrack, though, on their commitments, especially in light of the upcoming election. We expect to see many more companies pulling back on their commitments. We also expect to see many of them keep their commitments, but stop talking about the action they're taking on climate so that they don't get canceled by a different subset of consumers. So it's a very tricky line that we're walking right now. Stephen, how are you seeing some of that come to life?
Yeah, I mean, great point both of you. I think there are kind of three groupings to the companies that we sort of deal with. There's a significant cadre of companies that are banking on the status quo and that don't think either consumers or policy are going to go far enough to really change their business plan and get them to decarbonize their product. On the encouraging front, there is an increasing number of companies that are looking to lead. They recognize the business opportunity that decarbonization brings. I mean, on the scale of trillions across all these sectors, whether it's EVs, renewables, energy efficiency. So we're seeing increasing numbers of companies that are making these bold commitments to decarbonize and are really investing in making that transition away from fossil fuels. And then you've got a sort of middle cadre of companies that are curious and intrigued by the business proposition, but are also a bit more risk averse and are waiting to see sort of where the winds are going to lead in terms of decarbonization.
But can you just, is it like 30-30-30? Like really, be honest. Like how's the sliver that's like all in, how much of that sliver is it versus... Yeah. And I say this respectfully because in the stakeholder group I led at B Carbon, we had 7 of the major oil and gas companies. I've seen a lot firsthand, and you know, props to them for being a stakeholder and even sitting there through the conversations. But honestly, mm-hmm. Help me understand the slivers here.
That's a great question. And the data, it all comes down to the data, right? Like, what percentage of the highest emitting companies have a target? From some of the data, and this is on our website if anyone's interested, or you can go to the Science Based Targets Initiative as well. You can get a good sort of read as to Robin's question around what percentage of these companies are making meaningful commitments. In the S&P 500 in the United States, about half of those companies are disclosing information on emissions, which is encouraging. But also, you know, the other half is doing nothing, right? Of that half, maybe half, 25% of the total S&P 500 has a commitment that is aligned with net zero, and then a smaller percentage of that 25% we consider is sort of in the vanguard in terms of not only having a commitment that's aligned with net zero, but is also creating what we call a climate transition action plan, which we'll talk about later.
You want to call out, like, what does good corporate leadership look like to you? Are there any specific companies you'd like to call out for the way that they're approaching this?
I'm always nervous to do that because the minute I do that, that someone will point out that they're failing on some other part. It is a great question. None of these companies are perfect by any stretch. Some are doing great when it comes to renewables, not so great on energy efficiency. So it's hard to really single out a company that really stands up. Salesforce is doing great when it comes to the amount of renewables that they're buying. They have a commitment to go 100% renewables by 2030, I think it is. So they're really investing a ton in long-term contracts for wind, solar. So that's a company that I think is really leading when it comes to the amount of electricity, renewable electricity that they're purchasing, and they're a large consumer of electricity. Another one that I would highlight is in the power sector. Exelon is really doing a lot to sort of really invest in wind energy in particular, transmission. They could do more, but they are really taking big steps forward in terms of really converting their generation fleet to renewables.
Can I ask a question? Do we need every company to be like, and I'm going to do this even though you might not be able to, let's just be honest, Patagonia is like the outlier. Do we need all these Fortune 500 companies to be the Patagonia level of corporate responsible, or can we get there inch by inch like this?
Aaron?
Yeah, I think I think about what leadership looks like in climate a little bit differently, because I do think that the science-based targets, so those who have set science-based targets and are making progress, absolutely, we want more of that. But then I think about how are these companies setting themselves apart and communicating what they're doing. And so we absolutely advise clients all the time when they come to us and say, we want to be Ben & Jerry's, we want to be Patagonia, we say, why? You know, and we start asking those questions of what are your consumers' expectations of you as a brand? Is it necessary for you to, you know, take bold stances on climate? And it might be, because they, you know, not only does it advance their corporate purpose, but it advances the role they're playing in their communities. And that makes sense. But I think what corporate leadership looks like is being able not just to set targets, but not walking away from those targets midstream, and being able to have honest conversation with stakeholders and investors and other NGOs about the progress they're making and where they're falling short. Lego actually just did that this year when it comes to recyclability in their bricks. Lego is a client of mine, but we don't support their sustainability initiatives. We support their STEM education initiatives, just a disclosure. But they were able to say, look, we've searched and tried and piloted many efforts to meet this goal. It's not happening on time, but here's what we're doing to make sure that we can meet that goal long term.
Yeah, and there's obviously some really interesting corporate models around Lego and companies like Newman's Own, where Lego Foundation actually participates in the corporate side of Lego, right? So in both like cases where Newman's Own and Lego, the actual foundation is a stakeholder in the business, right? So it serves a greater purpose than maybe just a linear one that it would normally serve. Robin, I'm going to turn it back to you on this. I mean, you've consulted on climate strategy and other things for Louisiana's Economic Development Department, for Pennsylvania's Environmental Council, for Tulsa, Oklahoma, Dallas, Texas, the American Public Transport Association, the Clean Air Force of Central Texas, all these different bodies. What does good leadership look like in the public sector?
I'll give you a surprising answer right now because I live in a red state and I have clients in a lot of other red states. And to me, a lot of the leadership model right now, it has to be somewhat sneaky. Sneaky meaning small moves with huge impact without a lot of, and I apologize to the PR people up here, but without going for the big PR impact that just naturally gets a lot of blowback, especially in red states. A lot of the clients I admire the most are quietly, almost imperceptibly, making low-hanging fruit moves that have a lot of on. I measure everything on the ground, acre by acre, inch by inch. And if you look at it that way and you're not worried about the PR, you'd be amazed what you can get away with, especially in red states. An example a lot of people don't talk about, you'd be shocked how much climate mitigation you can get up in a park system. State parks, city parks, there's a lot of rewilding right now that can be done in Austin City Park since we're here in my town, I'll talk about that. Water protection, tree canopy, sneaky stuff that matters, especially when you have diverse stakeholders and you can find, hey, this is the consensus move, but let's just do it inch by inch, acre by acre, and not call a lot of attention to ourselves. To me, that quiet leadership, I went to a Quaker school. There's something about Quakerism and Buddhism that you don't have to be fancy to get some big things done.
I couldn't agree more. And I think, Robin, do you think that part of it is, and what we've been tracking is that consumers care mostly right now about issues they can see and feel. They're not worried about, 10 years from now, because it's really about, do I have access to clean water right now? Can I enjoy the features of my community right now? And so I think that's part of the reason that it's so important to focus on those things that are tangible.
Well, I'm going to be honest with you all. I've been working, I adopted a baby in 2001. I had been in the tech, I was a tech VP before that. And the night my son was born, I looked at him, he's the cutest baby ever, and his 15-year-old birth mom. And I had an epiphany. I was like, oh my God, this kid's going to grow up. When he's about 16 years old, he's going to look me dead in the eye and say, what did you do about climate, mom? And at that moment, I wasn't doing jack in 2001, I'll be honest. And that very night, I decided I'd quit my tech job and I would devote the rest of my life to climate. And that's been a hard road. But I have not had a lot of bad climate grief in the 22 years since my son was born. I've done all kinds of things. I've had really bad days, like all of us. But I never had bad climate grief until last week. The best climatologist, hydrologist in Texas, Dr. Robert Mace, gave a presentation on the extent of drought that Texas is in and what's going to happen to our water resources. I saw that presentation last Wednesday. I'm still, if you see me, I'm still shaking. It hit me like a tsunami. There are cities in Texas, they're predicting that we'll have no water within 6 years. We're not talking 60 years. No one's talking 2050. And to me, that is what's changing right now, is these what seem like far-off targets. They're not far off. And guys like Dr. Mace, they're saying, no, it's going to be not your kid's lifetime. It's your lifetime. It's right now. And that's what we have to deal to in an optimistic, practical, tangible, sneaky, quiet way.
Well, I'll just bring context to that. In 2023, just in the U.S., an estimated 2.5 million people were forced from their homes by weather-related disasters. That's an extraordinary amount, right? The Texas fires that have been raging for the last couple of months have released 3.4 million metric tons of carbon. At the moment, there are over 100 wildfires raging in the U.S., around 70 of those in Texas. But if you look at the states in which they're raging, it's Texas, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Michigan, Mississippi, Florida, Arizona, Louisiana, Missouri, right? These are, you know,
all red states.
All red states, right? And so in terms of your being sneaky good, we like to think that we're being sneaky good in the content that we distribute and that we get out there. We do partnerships and show the incredible work being done in partnership between companies like Whirlpool with Habitat for Humanity in terms of building more climate resilient housing. We did work with Qualcomm and their For Good initiatives that partnered with local nonprofits on the ground and local communications carriers in Indigenous communities around the world. We've worked with the United Nations Development Program and in conjunction with Hyundai on grassroots initiatives that are being done and highlighting those works. But just in that, like when we're talking about fossil fuels, what strikes me too is that there's such a massive percentage, right? Coal, oil, and gas, the largest contributor to climate change, account for 75% of global greenhouse gas emissions. But yet the Paris Climate Agreement doesn't even mention fossil fuels. So how do we stay motivated? How do we sustain public interest? How do we need to raise hysteria to COVID-like levels in order to treat it in the way that it needs to be treated?
I mean, first, that's a great question, and just want to amplify somewhat in response to your question what Robin just mentioned about sort of how the solution can sometimes be very bipartisan in nature, especially the more local you get. I think sometimes at that national level, it seems like there's a big schism and it's very partisan in nature. But from my experience working in state government, when it comes down at the state level in particular or the local level, you know, there are a lot of these bridges crossed in terms of, you know, crossing the aisle to create solutions on the climate front. So I think you made a very important point. If you look at the wind belt in the United States from Minnesota down to Texas, those are all red states, right? In order for the U.S. to get to net zero, it's going to entail building on the enormous amount of wind energy that's already installed in all of those states. The majority of renewables in the United States are installed in red states. So you touched on something that I think is very important and also partially an answer to your question around maintaining that momentum. I think accelerating the delivery of solutions is sort of the way to go. We've already seen significant penetration with EVs, wind, solar, battery storage, heat pumps. So accelerating that uptake amongst consumers, both corporate and individual, hopefully will get us to a point where we see a significant reduction in emissions.
Let me just mention one thing, because I don't want to talk about climate grief. I'm not sure I've ever publicly talked about climate grief in all my years. But I want us to remember Katrina. One of the toughest assignments I ever had was to go to New Orleans about 3 or 4 weeks after Katrina. The governor's office put together a big, y'all remember, big resilience and recovery program. And the planners, they hired the top planners in the U.S. to go down there and say, okay, how do we come back from this? But all the planners were afraid to go. Not physically afraid. Louisiana, if you know it, it's incredibly diverse. And the Texas politics, okay, look, nothing compares to Louisiana politics. So these planners were like, Rob, you go. You go get the stakeholders, scout out the stakeholders, get the stakeholders together, and when it's safe for us to go, when you've got the vibe the way it needs to be, then we'll come down. One of my hardest assignments ever. The most heartbreaking thing I ever heard during those early weeks was this economic firm came down and said, New Orleans will never come back. No companies will ever invest. You'll never insure a thing. You're talking to people. Can you imagine the gall of someone coming down to devastated post-Katrina people in saying such a thing? I don't shock easy, but that was the worst moment in that whole thing, besides the obvious physical devastation, was that company saying, you'll never come back. And you know what? How wrong was that? They came back. If you go to New Orleans, this is the thing I will say. Resilience is a real thing. And if you don't believe it, just go over to New Orleans and look around. And I want us to remember that. That was a lot of people coming together. That was the biggest stakeholder engagement, spontaneously combusted stakeholder, I got your back thing I've ever seen. And we are capable, we are so capable of, if that can happen after Katrina, we can do almost anything. And I really mean that. It's not, I'm not candy coating this. I'm saying it. I saw it.
Stephen, have we become desensitized to events like Katrina, given the frequency that these billion-dollar storms are happening now? Like, how do we maintain? Do we need a bigger crisis, or can we, you know, can you address that? Like, do we need hysteria, or can we have optimism and resilience lead the way?
Yeah, I think I don't think we've become desensitized. I think people are still very alarmed. Rob and I were just talking about the wildfire situation in New York and in the Northeast. And that was, you know, I'd never experienced anything like that in my growing up in Boston, seeing the, you know, the air quality deteriorate in the summer in Boston because of fires thousands of miles away in Canada. I mean, it was shocking for everyone in the Northeast, including New York. So I think people are increasingly alarmed at the frequency and the scale of these crises. I think corporate leadership and political leadership in particular will be incredibly important in terms of facilitating access to the technologies that will help each of us decarbonize. So for example, in our household, thanks to you know, progressive policies from our utility, we're pretty much completely off fossil fuels, right? We're 100% electric, we have no natural gas. We power our EV with 100% renewables, and this is all facilitated by both corporate leadership from a utility, as well as local leadership in state government and our town, all coming together to make it relatively easy for a consumer to make that shift. We just need to increase the scale at which that is available to people and make that happen faster across the entire country.
Can you give us a little bit of a sense of how easy that might be to achieve? So if we're kind of staying in the optimistic lane, is it one oil company? Is it doubling EVs? Like, what's going to create enough of a significance that we can say, yeah, you know what, we can knock that out pretty quickly?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think it's too patchy in the U.S. in terms of access to these technologies. So, for example, in Massachusetts, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's not as hard as it was 5 years ago. You know, you go to Arkansas or South Dakota, you may not have any access to renewables, right? So we need to get to a point where a significant percentage of the population can install a heat, an air source heat pump, charge their electric vehicle relatively easily, and power their entire residence with renewables fairly easily. I think, and Robin, you touched on this earlier, you know, do we have to have the entire S&P 500 committing to go net zero? Probably not. There's maybe 20% of each of these sectors, 20% of those companies, if they commit to decarbonizing and actually take steps to decarbonize before 2030 and reduce their emissions by 50%, I think that'll put us on the track where we get to net zero by 2050 or earlier.
Great. And Aaron, you know, given that fossil fuels were like the worst performing sector in the market in the last decade, and that there could be incredible investment in renewable jobs versus fossil fuel jobs and things like that, what do you think from a messaging standpoint? How are we getting, what kind of good messaging are you seeing out there that's reaching either the right people or the right generational mindsets?
I mean, I think what's happened, especially over the past 10 years, but increasingly over the past five, is there's so much of a focus on the political discourse and kind of trying to wage this war in the headlines and convince people of who's the villain and who's the hero in the conversation around fossil fuels. And it's so complicated. What we haven't talked about yet, and I know we will, is the government subsidizing the fossil fuel industry versus subsidizing renewables. So we need to talk about that, because we know that the willpower is there, and if consumers and individuals did have access to more renewables across the country and around the world, they would use them. So we've seen that. I think that the debate around science is one of the things that we've lost a lot of ground on, and we've really seen a lack of trust in science by politicians and by their constituents. And so one of the things that I think we've gotten caught up in is, I remember back at COP19 when I was working at Ceres and running communications for the UN Investor Summit, where we were so excited to see momentum by mainstream investors saying, yes, we need to see big oil diversifying their portfolios. We're not asking them to stop drilling. We're asking them to do that while they're also pursuing alternate forms of renewables. And we saw that kind of wave of progress happening. But what we then saw right away was when the IPCC would release a report connecting these increasingly, kind of challenging weather events to climate change, people were like, oh, no, you can't connect climate change to extreme weather. And so that was one of those moments for me that made me think we need to talk about this stuff differently. We need to talk about how there are long-term solutions and solutions today. And really, I think what we've seen, especially for the fossil fuel treaty, for example, is that they've been able to mobilize a grassroots network of hundreds of thousands of young people who already know and are feeling the impacts of climate change in their day-to-day and who are actually pressuring governments to change the way they're thinking about subsidies, for example.
Yeah, great. Just a couple of stats that I know we talked about before the panel, but by 2025, you can expect 86% of coal plants could be replaced by renewables at a lower cost to consumers. And by 2030, renewables will be cheaper than coal nearly everywhere, like globally. So exactly that, like, why doesn't the public sector spend more dollars subsidizing renewables rather than subsidizing fossil fuels? Right. Anyone have a good answer for that?
I mean, it's a great question. I mean, the encouraging aspect of the stat that Elliot just mentioned is that most of those coal plants, those are old. There are very few new coal plants that are being built in the United States. And that's primarily for economic reasons. You know, natural gas, wind in particular, are now cost competitive in most parts of this country with coal. So part of what, to Aaron's point about the communications aspect and how we talk about this, especially from sort of the corporate and investor perspective, the risk of not investing in renewables and clean energy solutions is on the scale of trillions of dollars for most of these S&P 500 companies. Any of those companies that are not investing in this transformation are putting themselves and their assets and their investors at great and tremendous risk by not doing so. On the opportunity side, there are also trillions of dollars to be made by companies that do make the transition as well.
I just feel as an activist, and I'm not challenging you, I feel like I need to say natural gas is not a clean energy. Just
agreed.
Point taken. Yep. I know you all understand.
I fully agree with that.
Yeah, I was looking at a cartoon by this lady, Megan Herbert, and I just stumbled across it on Insta the other day. But she had this picture of Utopia, and like everything had been solved, and the people walking along are talking, and they're like, well, what do you think changed? What do you think brought about the change? And they were like, well, if you want to get carbon, people to invest in carbon renewal, in carbon removal and to decrease carbon, it was all precipitated. The change was all precipitated when we started calling them carbs.
Actually, can I make a point here?
So we stopped calling carbon carbon, we start talking about them as carbs, everyone will want to reduce them.
I love that cartoon. I did want to make this one point real quick. And I say this as somebody that spent 4 years working in the voluntary carbon market on soil sequestration, forest sequestration, blue carbon, methane, all the things. I love that work. But part of my conclusion is if we don't quit talking about carbon pretty quick, we're never going to get there. We need to be talking about water, and we need to be talking about rewilding, stuff people understand. No one understands carbon. You can't see it. You can barely measure it. Honestly, the smartest thing we could do from a messaging standpoint is focus on water, water, water. If you have water, you're going to get carbon. And, is that
and
straightforward?
I agree with that. And the resiliency of the cities where people are living. So what is happening to your cities and your homes? That is, I agree 100%.
We've got a couple of questions I'd love to get to.
Just
say your name as well.
My name is Chloe Karova. I'm an investment manager. I'm an asset manager. My company's Modern Capital Concepts, based in Chicago.
Thanks,
Chicago,
Chloe.
Illinois, blue state in a sea of red. You know, one of the things that a lot of investment managers, because there's been a backlash against ESG, and so there's this debate amongst professional money managers, should we just drop the term ESG? Because there's sort of fatigue about talking about carbon, the net zero, whatever. And the way that I've sort of been reframing this, you know, need to take action around climate change is like, there's an economic development opportunity. And I look at it as like, when you have, and cost of renewable energy is coming down, you know, and where there is cheap energy, you're gonna see business development, right? And I'm like, this is one of the things that I'm wondering is like, are we seeing with the municipalities or, you know, governments making the case for renewables? It's like, hey, look, you know, we have cheap energy. This is where we're gonna see, we are going to attract development. You know, what business, right? You know, isn't interested in lowering their operational expenses with cheaper clean energy.
Well, let me give some props to the city of Austin. The city of Austin, a lot of people don't realize this. The city of Austin started investing in green energy way before it was cool. We had a legendary head of Austin Energy, our municipally owned utility, and we started investing in wind and solar back when it was super expensive to do it. And we did it anyway. We did it kind of sneaky, but we did it. And the role of municipalities in investing, Austin Energy was a market maker, and they knew they were doing. Are you smiling because you're from Austin Energy? Thank you, baby. Good job. Good on you. Very inspiring. But the role, you know, and I'm not bragging on my city. Austin has a lot to answer for. Recently, we asked the mayor, how much have we spent on climate mitigation in the last 5 years? No one knows, and honestly, I think it's because it was not very much. But certain things that we did back in the 90s, electric vehicle investment, green energy investment, it's paying off now like you can't believe. The role of the public sector, especially, okay, states, take your chances in red states. Cities and counties. I wish Commissioner Bridget Shea was here. Travis County, where we are right now, has done some of the best climate work in the country at the county level with minimal county powers.
Great, thanks.
Hi, my name is Isabel Gonzalez-Whitaker.
Hi, Isabel. Almost a panelist here today.
Right, sorry, I have my 11-year-old son waiting outside, but I did not want to miss this. This has been incredibly informative, and yes, I'm sorry I couldn't join. So I'm the AVP of Moms Clean Air Force. We're part of the Environmental Defense Fund. We are a programmatic unit that really mobilizes the power of 1.5 million moms and caregivers around the country to mobilize in their communities in reaction to things that are happening in their communities. And then we also advocate at the highest levels of power and influence at the Capitol. So my question is actually about media. I'm actually a former journalist, and I know we bond a little bit over that. What's it doing right? What's it doing wrong? You know, in my role of trying to bring visibility to the work that we're doing and the stories of families on the front lines, I'm connecting it to the broadest audience possible through, you know, relatable through lines. Who's doing it right? Who's doing it wrong? How can we help media? And I don't just mean traditional media, I mean including social media as well, and the voices on social media that are advocating. How do we help them connect to the broadest audience possible?
I'll hand this to Erin, and then I've got some thoughts as well. Thanks,
Thank
Isabel.
You.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, I think one of the things that media in general, traditional media outlets, broadcast, print, online, that they're really chasing the story around woke capitalism and the term ESG, and we've even, somebody already brought that up. Are we using, what are we calling this anymore? And like turning this into a heroes and villains debate is one of the things the media has really perpetuated in a way that's incredibly, incredibly challenging. Instead of talking about what's at risk in your town, in your city, in your community, we're talking about who are we blaming for this and who is going to lead the charge to change or not. So that's one thing. The other thing is they're cutting resources. So we have the Society for Environmental Journalism, as some of you may have worked with before, journalists who have spent decades getting smart about these topics, who can report on things in a way that drive action at the local level. Local papers and outlets are folding. We have a lot of initiatives are being funded now to try to bring back some of that investigative local journalism. So we need to see that, because right now I think, to name an outlet or two that are doing really well, Axios continues to really invest and climate change storytelling to the point where they're even talking about, you know, how forecasters and weather experts are communicating to communities about what to do in around climate change and natural disasters. Time Magazine and some folks over there continue to do a great job, but overall, we need to do better. One other point is that there's 20 billion views on TikTok of videos related to climate change. And so if companies are afraid or scaling back their communications around this stuff, who, and I think it will come down to a lot of the organizations like yours doing incredible work, are able to be funded enough to fund initiatives that focus on TikTok content creation, for example, to reach young people on these issues. So I hope that helps answer.
This is going to sound ironic coming from me, but honestly, and I say this strictly from an environmental standpoint, I'm not globalizing this, I think we're in the post-journalism world now. And what I mean by that is, what works, and I'm talking about grassroots, when I'm doing my, you know, climate change work for real, protecting water for real in Texas, on the ground stuff, it's not, no one's reading The Statesman, no one's listening to KUT, certainly no one's listening to CBS, no one I know. And what they are doing is, it's personal stories, it is TikTok. People, if you talk to young people, Houston Tillotson is the local historically black college here. We have a project with some young journalism students there. None of them read the New York Times. None of them read that. You ask them, where do you get your news? My friends. If I need to, I Google something. Who they trust, their friends. And so you're not looking for, I love my dad, but you don't need Dan Rather anymore. That is actually, I think that model might be totally obsolete. Read the book Ghosting the News.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time where we're kind of wondering who to trust, right? And so we're going to trust the people we can see physically around us. I'll give a shout out to the Solutions Journalism Network, which is a whole group of different people who are contributing positive, solutions-minded journalism around the world to different outlets. I was at Skoll World Forum last year, and they were heavily represented there. Unfortunately, though, they're relying heavily on philanthropic dollars, right? And so you have a Midyard network and Pierre Midyard doing excellent work in the space and funding a lot of documentary and investigative journalism. The problem, again, is that as someone who primarily does documentary-style content, the people who make documentaries are mostly making them for people who watch documentaries. And that happens to be a very small subset of the population. And so what I like to do, which is to borrow what Robin's talking about is being sneaky, is like producing small segments of news for all these local channels and syndicated stations around the country who can't actually afford to produce their own news and are just using news from other sources. And so if some of those sources can be things that we're producing and then serving up to them about a local hero, et cetera, we can actually be pretty remarkably specific in the communities that we're reaching, and that we're reaching in places across the country, not just thinking about it as red, blue, purple, etc. And just being sneaky in that way is actually really positive, and also thinking about what messaging works. If we want someone to build solar panels and get off grid and invest in that, sometimes the messaging is not about climate, it's about not trusting local grids and government to have your back. And so the same result might be achieved in a number of different communication manners, depending on the population that you're addressing. And that just needs to be accepted. And like our motto as a company, Nation of Artists, is ideas plus empathy equals impact. You can't have a great idea and just disperse it randomly. You have to know what the people are receptive of and what they need. And so if you can apply that empathetic lens to the impactful solutions that you have ideas around, that's when you get change. And likewise, we can have all the empathy in the world, but at some point we have to acknowledge, you know, the hand-holding, acknowledge the feelings, and come up with an idea that's going to move us past that stagnant state of just emoting. Another question?
Can I just make one point? Because I really feel like I have to say this. First of all, I apologize to every journalist in the world for saying we're in a post. Possibly I need to walk that back, y'all. But I also want to say, I think one of the things that's changed about messaging is people have actually felt climate impacts. In Austin, snow apocalypse. Last year, 115, 120 degree days, many of them. The messaging we can do with empathy, it's different because it's not theoretical. It's not 2030, 2050, oh my gosh, last week. And that changes the message and who the messenger can be. Go ahead, question.
Hi, Duncan from Clean Creatives, fellow Austinite. Thank you for all your work. What we do is we work with people in advertising and PR, and then their clients to shut down fossil fuel advertising and PR campaigns. My intuition is that...
That's some sneaky stuff.
We're very public about it, though. My intuition is that most people like climate solutions. You ask them, would you prefer to have polluting energy or clean energy? They will choose that. The impact of fossil fuel PR is doubt. It's telling people that it's not reliable, it's too expensive, it's too controversial. And so in particular for Robin and Stephen, how have you seen those stories about clean energy and climate action impact decision makers, whether it's in local government or in companies? Are you seeing them respond to those messages of, oh, it's too hard, it's too expensive? And how would you like to see sort of the PR and advertising industry change its work to make those messages less prolific?
I think, Duncan, one quick point to you, just to kind of set up my response here, but one of the things that we know is that big oil and its allies are outspending the storytelling and the clean energy group by 27 times when it comes to shaping the narrative around fossil fuels, right? And so it's really hard, just from a basic financial perspective, for clean energy groups, organizations, and individuals to counter narratives that are being built both in traditional media and online. So when it comes to seeing the impact of positive storytelling on clean energy investments and clean energy projects, my point there is that not enough is being spent or invested in actually telling those stories, and that we can continue to funnel either investor funds or foundation funds to the groups who have the ability to reach those tens of millions of followers online. And because when you think about, Robin, to your point, what is driving behavior change? It is people hearing from their friends, right? It is them being encouraged to take an action, to contact their elected official, to ask them to take these things seriously and support clean energy investments. So I think in order to see a spike in the impact of storytelling around clean energy investments and progress, we do need to see an increase in the funding going toward groups who can shape the dialogue in traditional and non-traditional media.
I think it really depends. That was such a good, it's one of the best questions I've heard in a long time, dude. Well done. Stumped the band in a way. But I wanted to ask you, what audience are you talking about? Because if we're talking about a consumer audience, that's another thing. In Texas, I've lived in Texas, I'm fifth generation Texan on both sides of my family. I've lived here for 30 years. If you ask me what messages move the Texas legislature, there is no message. And I say that, I'm gonna say it again. There is no message you got, no matter how genius it is, that will change a single mind up there, right up the street. And I say that so ruefully, it's unbelievable. The only thing that changes those minds is Benjamin's. That's the only thing. And so part of what I would say is take all the money you can possibly get and put it in PACs. Because if you're trying to change policy at the red state level, it's not about messaging. It's not.
And of course, it's not as dire as that in totality, because you have corporate citizens and agencies and others who can commit resources to changing the needle and taking the banner and doing things regardless, right, of what the local government is doing as well. And so we're seeing a lot of that, and have done since the Paris Climate Agreement and things like that, where companies are willing to step out and say that they're doing things for the benefit of their consumers. And yeah, they have to choose their language carefully, but the ultimate thing is that they can be more profitable by reaching people on this with this platform.
Stephen, Ceres does a lot to equip its, especially members of the Bicep Network, so the companies that actually move forward and help lobby. I know that Elisa and some others have been part of companies that support Capitol Hill lobbying, and federal and state lobbying, excuse me, on these issues. And part of the messaging resonance that I think was really helpful was when they're, think about a Mars, company like Mars, of course, they're private, so it's a little easier for them to take a stand and equip consumers on how to actually talk about these issues with their elected officials. I think about Mars as an example of a company that tend to do this really well. They're not just showing up and investing in clean energy solutions, they're also equipping other stakeholders to do that kind of work.
Yeah, great point, Aaron, and agreed. That was a fantastic question, and kudos to the great work that you and your team are doing on the ground on that issue. You know, I think state government, or at least in Massachusetts, tends to be very responsive to that voice. We just had our long story short, we every year bring businesses to Capitol Hill to meet with policymakers, legislators on these issues. So they're up there for a week, and the policymakers get to hear from some of these leading companies around climate, clean energy solutions. This year, the big focus was around how companies are using IRA funds to deploy clean energy and the like. So long-winded sort of piling on to what Aaron just mentioned, that that corporate voice in particular can be very helpful. I have to say, before I went into state government in Massachusetts, I was a bit skeptical about sort of the civic process and how much access consumers and folks who are not as organized or who don't have deep pockets can actually affect state policy. And thankfully, at least in Massachusetts, that voice was very powerful in terms of creating new legislation and regulations that accelerated the deployment of clean energy. So,
yeah. We've got time for just a couple more questions. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Sandra Fabiano. Thank you for all the work that you do. I was thinking about what you said as far as Texas is concerned. Recently, now as an EV owner, they're charging us extra money to drive on the roads.
Only in Texas, they do that.
It's crazy. Even though, you know, we barely get out of the house because we work from home, but, you know, we're paying extra hundreds of dollars per year, which is nuts. So I think it really comes down to voting. You know, and one of the things I was thinking of, you know, I would have my signs out, which would then get tossed by people and things like that. But maybe if we say vote for climate or vote for water or vote, you know, maybe make that message. And I don't know if there are organizations probably already doing this, but that was just my thought.
All right. Thank you. Is there another question? Yeah. Oh, two more.
The theme of kind of policy engagement, my name's Corey Skelton with SLR Consulting, formerly Corporate Citizenship, and policy is the place where I'm finding the doors are still closed for those of us working with companies that we've made, especially the past decade. We've made such inroads into so many parts of the business. We're in product development, we're in supply chain, we're in core business planning. We're talking with IR, we're talking with every part of the business, but the place where there's just no willingness in the part of most companies, and I hear this from my counterparts in other kind of professional services and internal roles, is that those who are sort of managing the company's political engagement do not want to talk about the kind of sustainability goals of the company. And that often, if we look underneath the hood, there's sort of a quiet understanding that you hedge your bets and you fund both sides, and that companies and funding of candidates, their lobbying efforts are not necessarily in line with their public commitments or their actions in other areas. So my question to all of you is, what have you seen work? What have you, I think we've gotten so much better as a profession at sort of making the business case to companies around so many different aspects of how they engage with sustainability, but policy, I think we're not there yet, and I'm wondering if you have any kind of success stories of convincing companies to engage there.
Yeah, so you're talking about corporate policy?
So talking about their engagement with public policy.
Okay, yep.
Yeah, I think on the series does a lot of this, but I think part of it is going in at the right moment in time with realistic asks. So we're not going in and asking for you to, you know, defund or lobby for a fossil fuel phase out necessarily. We're actually talking about how the Inflation Reduction Act should be applied locally to help boost the economy, right? How can it be used to help protect the waterways and build climate resiliency? So I think we made a lot of progress in breaking through and getting the meetings probably 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Now the policy engagement for corporations become, how do you get in a room and have a realistic dialogue with an individual who is not there for morality, they're not there for moral reasons, they're not there for altruistic reasons, they're not there to save the planet. And I think we did a disservice from a corporate communications perspective for a long time, talking about 2030, 2050, and our ambition versus what do we need to change now and why. So I think coming back to that really, you know, I think real tangible issues is what's going to matter most and what's at stake if action isn't taken from an economic perspective.
Just real quick, I know we're out of time, but I would also say the role of trade associations, power in numbers, so it's not you taking the risk, it's your stakeholder group or your peer group of companies that can be a little braver than an individual company might feel like they can be.
Yeah, and just to close out on that, from a storytelling standpoint, we try and identify an individual who represents the issue. Some people just have trouble, like you're saying, with 2030, 2050, all these numbers, 2.5 million, whatever it is. It's just hard to take it all personally, but when it becomes immediate, it becomes actionable. And so we like to say, like others like to say, no stories without numbers, no numbers without stories. You don't know what's going to reach someone on a given day to take action. They could be like the most hard-nosed numbers person who wants to see the stats every other day but that day. That day they've had something happen in their life that makes them more emotive, and you reach them with a story and all of a sudden they're like, ah, screw it, I'm just going to help, right? And similarly, you can have the most emotive person, the most empathic person who's just tired after a while and says, just show me the numbers. So whenever you're addressing any of these things, if you're addressing a person, no numbers without stories, no stories without numbers. I know that we're out of time, but I'm happy to stay. You're happy to stay. Robin might have
a few minutes.
We can take them personally. So feel free to come up and have a chat with any of us. Thank you so much for being such an amazing, active audience. We super appreciate it and hope you had a great South By. Thanks so much.